The following interview was recorded in 2012 and hasn't been shared again since moving my podcast hosting to Podbean. This year, 2016, is the 75th anniversary of the Screwtape Letters first coming out weekly in a small church publication before being released in 1942 in the book we now know. So it seemed like the perfect time to re-release this conversation. I've since done two other interviews so far with Paul McCusker, but they haven't been reposted yet, so be sure to look for them in the days ahead. One more thing, be sure to visit ScrewtapeCompanion.com to learn about a book I've done that is different from the following material. My book is a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters, and so it complements the book discussed in the following interview.
And I was more worried in some respects about the things I was missing than the things that were obvious. And so it was hard work and very intimidating.
I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com, and thanks for joining me for another All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. With me on the show today is Paul McCusker. Paul is here to share about a special annotated edition of the Screwtape Letters that was released in 2013. Welcome to All About Jack, Paul.
Well, thanks. Good to be with you.
Let's kick off by addressing a question I've heard some have. It's somewhat of a two-parter, but the overarching one is, why even have an annotated edition of the Screwtape Letters? Kind of part one is, it's such a short book of satire, and then second, shouldn't those who want to learn about references Lewis makes in the book not be so lazy and do their own research?
Well, there's a kind of a two-part answer to the question. One is, the overriding goal whenever I've worked on C.S. Lewis projects, whether it's the audio dramas or something like the annotated Screwtape, I feel like sort of Arthur Fiedler with the Boston Pops, back when he expressed his mandate, that his goal was to make classical music as accessible to the populace as possible. He wanted to get classical music out of the realm of upper class, oh, that's for the intelligentsia or people that aren't like me. And he almost became a bit of a laughingstock among, I want to say, diehard classical music buffs, because he pretty much did whatever he had to do to make it accessible. And it's the same thing, not that we want to be laughingstocks, but with the audio dramas, for example, we wanted to do audio dramas from our expertise that would either introduce people to the work of C.S. Lewis, like with Chronicles of Narnia and Screwtape, or reintroduce people. A lot of people that I had talked to who, for example, with Screwtape, they had read it years ago and hadn't picked it up since. And one of the reasons why they hadn't picked it up was because even though it's very funny and they got, you know, glimpses of themselves in it, they had a hard time with references that they either glossed over or, you know, they just couldn't be bothered to look up. And a lot of times people are reading these things on airplanes and they're wherever they happen to be. And so easy access to the references just wasn't available to them. So the first thing is the big picture, which is why even do it? Well, part of it is to try to introduce Lewis or reintroduce Lewis to a lot of people. And, you know, the diehard fans, I have no doubt that they know what all the references are, and they've looked them up and they have their answers. And a book like this may or may not be helpful to them. I don't know. But for the average reader, the goal was to make Lewis even more accessible to them. So that's kind of the first part. And second part, by the way, was when I was doing the dramatization of Screwtape Letters, our team came up against questions. What does that mean? What is he referring to? And I began to realize that a lot of what he was referring to were things that weren't even overt, so that they're flagged in a way that you would think, oh, wait a minute, he's referring to something that I should look up, because it just kind of flows along with his references. And then finally, a big part of it is, he wrote this in 1940, 41, 42, and a lot of the things that he assumed that his audience would know, remembering that his original audience was the Guardian Church of England newspaper, a lot of people had been reading what he read. He knew what they knew. He knew what was on their bookshelves. He knew what their education across the board probably was. And so he wrote according to that. Now, you know, we're all these years later, and a lot of people just don't even know what he's referring to. Some of the stuff is obscure. Some of it are British. He uses British expressions that even the British don't use. My wife is British, and there were expressions in there that she wasn't familiar with. And so I thought, well, okay, so even though his writing is timeless in a lot of ways, it is dated. And it's actually worth explaining what some of those things are. So I hope that doesn't sound too convoluted, but that's really what was behind it. It was just an opportunity to introduce people to Lewis and then to help them a bit to understand what he's talking about without interpreting the material.
No, I really like the way you answered that. And part of what you started out with and then towards the end in terms of noting about reintroducing Lewis, today, of course, he is more known for Narnia, which didn't come out until the 50s. This, many people aren't maybe as aware of, in that this was his first claim to fame. This started one of his problems early in terms of being famous, and that is getting all the mail that he did. It's kind of ironic that here his claim to fame was a set of letters.
But that's right.
Yeah. Well, anyway, well, dropping back, let's consider details about how you came to be the person doing this book, the annotated version of the Screwtape Letters. After all, you're not a Lewis scholar.
Right, and I was very careful in any of the publicity material. In some of the early copy, they said, okay, Lewis expert Paul McCusker, and I laughed, and I said, but the real Lewis experts will have me for lunch. I don't purport to be a Lewis expert as much as a Lewis enthusiast, and some of that's by default. Some of it that is through my own level of interest in C.S. Lewis and getting to know him, but a big part of it has to do with the focus on the family radio theater that we've been producing for the last 15 years. And doing the Chronicles of Narnia, the seven books, and dramatizing them helped a lot in terms of my relationship with Doug Gresham, who is C.S. Lewis's stepson. And Doug and I have a good relationship and a good friendship, and there's a lot of trust in that. So he trusted us with Narnia, that we would stay true to the source material, we weren't going to do a Hollywood thing, that we were going to do our very best with audio drama. And so later, when we asked him about Screwtape Letters, he was agreeable to that because he trusted us from previous experience with Chronicles of Narnia. And it was during that time that I had said to him that the scripts that I was working on had kind of gotten a reaction from our team and other people who read them, who said, well, we're missing a lot of things that he seems to be saying. And we don't understand some of the words and phrases, or he's referencing authors we've never heard of, or various things we don't know. And so I went back to them and said, you know, somebody really ought to do an annotated version of this. And Doug said, absolutely not. I really dislike annotated versions because they too often interpret the material. They don't sort of explain the background. They actually work to tell people what Lewis meant in these passages. And he said, and I don't like that. He said, I prefer for people to read it for themselves and understand it for themselves, but you know, let them interpret it for themselves. And so I asked him, what about an annotated version that doesn't interpret, that all it does is try to enlighten through referencing the phrases and authors and concepts that Lewis is pointing to, but a lot of modern readers wouldn't know them. And, really, with the assurance that if I tried my hand at this, I wouldn't interpret, he was relaxed. But I did say, I'm not a scholar. And he said, well, that's one reason why I would let you do it. He said, scholars too often try to interpret the material. And every scholar, I guess, who has approached him about an annotated version suffered from that. That when he looked at what they were trying to do, it too often crossed the line. So he actually thought that because I wasn't a scholar, I would create something that was more accessible to more people rather than an academic treatise, which he simply didn't want. So what I considered a flaw, he considered a benefit, you know, that I wasn't a scholar. Yeah. Actually, he felt made it better for me to do it. Now, I went into this with fear and trepidation, and I say that candidly, that to tackle something like this and to hit the footnotes and to try to get all the footnotes right, and I was more worried in some respects about the things I was missing than the things that were obvious. And so it was hard work and very intimidating to tackle this project. And all we can do is watch and see how people respond to it and hope that it does what we wanted it to do, which is get people excited about C.S. Lewis in general and Screwtape Letters in particular.
Yes, isn't it ironic? Sometimes what we consider our biggest disqualifications may be our best qualifications, and there are many biblical examples of that. Mm-hmm. Turning to the annotations themselves, what can readers expect? What are the more common type of background information you provide? And then give us some examples of the annotations.
Well, a handful of things. I tried several different levels. One was to explore the ideas that Lewis would reference in other works. For example, I think it's in Letter 25, Screwtape actually uses the phrase mere Christian, and this predates mere Christianity. So I have a footnote explaining where the phrase mere Christian and mere Christianity came from, and point to where Lewis had read it, and basically attributing the source of Lewis's quote. There are other examples where I would reference either letters or other concepts that he would explore either prior to this or after this, where you get a seed of an idea, a theological idea or a point of reference that might cross over into mere Christianity or even the Great Divorce or other types of other writings by Lewis, and trying to explore those themes. So that's kind of one level. One is Lewis himself. If there was anything that emerged that struck me as being almost autobiographical, I would point to that and point to where I found it, either in his letters or out of Surprised by Joy, his spiritual autobiography, or other biographies that had picked up some of those things. So that's another point of reference, something that might go into his life that might enlighten our understanding of what he was talking about. And then other things are, in a sense, more mundane, and that would be just words and phrases that aren't in common usage. Another, in one of the letters, he refers to Sol Colbert, which is a dish of a particular fish dish that a lot of people don't know. I'm glancing at the book now, and I see that I define querulousness, you know, which is a certain word that doesn't come trippingly to the tongue, and a lot of people don't necessarily know. And then in the more British realm, he references like a passbook, which is simply a bank book. But Americans might not think of that. They might think of, maybe a passport of some sort. And then they wind up thinking the wrong thing as they're trying to understand the material. There's a British phrase like scored off. He used the phrase scored off. Well, we might be thinking he's talking about sports when in fact it is to get the better of another person. To be scored off is to be humiliated, you know, that sort of thing. And so the book is riddled with phrases that were common enough in 1940-41 England, but don't translate well to American because we just don't know it. And so the book, it's just all kinds of references like that. And then, of course, there's any reference that I can give to history when he references various artists or other writers. He'll quote from various things without necessarily attributing the quote. And part of the fun for me in some cases was finding out who he was quoting and what the greater context was for the quote. He references George Bernard Shaw in a couple of places, even makes fun of the name. But there was a whole yeah. philosophy behind that. So I try to explain what he's referring to.
And I looked, it was letter 25 that you mentioned early about the mere Christianity reference or merely Christian. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I see that I don't know that I have seen in any other articles that discuss mere Christianity, maybe it's there, but I didn't notice it, but that you not only mention who it was, but the book itself, which I don't believe I've ever seen anyone else mention what book of Baxter's that the expression is used. So that's very helpful. Let's get a little bit more personal and have you share what the Screwtape Letters has meant to you personally, or how you came about to maybe enjoy it.
Well, it's interesting. Any encounter with C.S. Lewis for me is insightful and enlightening. There isn't anything that he's written, apart from even maybe his poetry, but it's because I'm not a very clever person with poetry. But even there, actually, I've found insight and inspiration. I find Lewis, across the board, one of the best Christian writers I've ever encountered. So the takeaway for me varies from, I mean, with Screwtape, of course, you have all these letters, and each one is dealing sort of thematically with a different aspect of humanity, of temptation, of rationalization, of the things that influence us in terms of our thinking and how we fall into the folly of things like, I love it when he tackles the issue of like the real world, you know, that we think of the spiritual realm as being sort of pie in the sky and detached from us. And then we talk about it, oh, well, it's the real world. We play these mind games without stopping to think, how are we defining this? What do we mean by that? And that was one of the things that kept coming back, was this diabolical attempt to keep us from thinking, from giving anything too much thought, because as soon as we did, we were in danger of entering the enemy's camp, the enemy being Screwtape's enemy, meaning God. And so all of those things were easily taken on board by me. I'm not untouched by this. It wasn't an academic exercise or a strictly objective exercise. As I had to pour through them for the drama and then for this book, all of this material becomes illuminated. And you, in a sense, to put it crudely, you take it personally. You can't not read Lewis and avoid taking what he's writing personally. And that to me is the wonder of it. And I think that's why 50 years after his death, we're still talking about him and his writings.
Well, you've made a few references to the family radio theater production of the Screwtape Letters. Go ahead and give us some details about that for people who maybe aren't familiar with it.
Well, and that was an interesting thing. It's one thing to dramatize the Chronicles of Narnia. It's another thing to dramatize the Screwtape Letters, which is obviously a series of letters. And we knew we didn't want to do a book on tape. There were plenty of those. John Cleese had done a version, which we considered definitive in a lot of ways. He just, through the Basil Fawlty approach that he does so well, he seemed to capture that, I want to say the snotty bureaucrat that Screwtape appears to be. And so we said, well, if we're going to dramatize it, how do we dramatize it? And part of that was to try to go what we call in scene, that there are things that Screwtape describes that we thought, well, we can dramatize those. We can actually hear the patient, and we can hear the patient's encounter with his mother or with his girlfriend or with his friends, and try to dramatize those sections that we could dramatize, but allow Screwtape to speak very clearly as he does. I will say that the thankless job in the drama was on the part of the actor who played Wormwood, because, of course, so much of what Wormwood would do when we convert the letters into more or less dialogue is to ask the questions that lead into, you know, the next response, which is the next piece of insight. Now, it's not all like that. We do have some sections where Screwtape is dictating a letter, or he is approaching the material in a different way. And now, a big part for us was the actor. And we knew we had to get somebody really good and somebody who would bring a dynamic to the material that would be fresh and would make people sit up and take notice. And again, our goal is to introduce or reintroduce people to the Screwtape Letters. And the only way to do that is to find a fresh angle. So we went round and round with different actors. And Andy Serkis, who played Gollum in Lord of the Rings, kept coming up. Now, if everyone's thinking that he's doing Gollum, he's not. Andy has a remarkable voice, very resonant and powerful. And so we thought, well, we'll go at it that direction. We will bring a whole new dynamic to it. And Andy was amazing. He was astonishing in the studio. But here's the inside thing. He said, and I think he said it in the documentary material we produced, it was the hardest work he'd ever had to do. And it, and at one point I said, wait a minute, you were crawling around on all fours as Gollum for 5 years and this is harder? He said, yes, this is far harder than that. With Gollum, it was physical, you know, and he could reach the end of the day and, you know, have a hot bath or something and be fine. But he was going home from the studio and he was saying to his wife, I am absolutely exhausted. I just can't even think. And she's like, oh, you're just exaggerating. Don't be such a baby. And he said, no, you don't understand what this is like. And I can tell you what it was like, because he not only had the difficult task of just going through the very intricate phraseology that Lewis uses. And I will say, I found out very quickly that if I even tried to rephrase anything that C.S. Lewis wrote, that it sort of came undone. Because there's an intricacy to how he puts together and works through his logic and his thoughts. So I couldn't touch that, which then meant that Andy not only had to make that come alive just at face value, but then to perform it, to do it as an actor and make sense of it, was like double damage. So he would get through a take of a section of it. And it would be powerful and dynamic, and he would just bring so much to it by way of nuance and his acting was amazing. But we'd get to the end of the take, and I'd punch the button and say, Andy, that was amazing, but I didn't understand a word you said. And a few times he laughed and said, well, that's all right, neither did I. And then he would have to go back and do it again, bringing together performance with meaning. So all of that, I think, shows through when you listen to it. And by the way, I would never encourage anybody to listen to it top to bottom without breaks. I think it's best listened to in the same way that Lewis wrote it as letters. You just take a chunk of it, take one of the sections, which basically is one of the letters, and then stop and listen and think and go through it and then do another one the next day. I've talked to people who said they were doing road trips and started at the very beginning and went all the way through to the end. And I just thought, I think my brain would explode if I had to do that. I just couldn't imagine how you do it.
Well, going back to the annotated edition of the Screwtape Letters, what were maybe some of the more challenging details you had to track down to find for the book?
Well, there is, it's funny, one that immediately comes to mind is there was a phrase he uses, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the letter, but it was like, done a corner in. Just a simple phrase, done a corner in. And I must have spent a day, I think, maybe even longer, chasing after just that phrase. And it's one of those phrases that when you read it, you think, oh, well, I sort of know what he means. But when you actually try to pin it down to define it and to figure out more specifically what it means, that was a big challenge. So even something as mundane as a phrase like that, I had to spend a lot of time tracking down to make sure I was getting it right so that it made sense in the context he was using it. And I'd done a corner and actually has some derivative back to 1800s, late 19th century into this century. And it's a variation of it might be how someone gets a corner in the market. And so done a corner in is a variation on that, and yet not even specifically that. So if you look at the footnote, it sort of unpacks just that phrase, which, again, you could slide past, and many, many people probably have over the years, either assuming they knew what it meant or didn't care what it meant. But I thought, well, it was important enough. He wrote it, so it's important enough to clarify if there's any way to do that. There is another letter, by the way, where he references a quote from someone, but he never says who that someone is. And I spent ages trying to dig that one out, trying to see if I could identify who it was. Was it one of the Inklings? Was it a friend? Was it Lewis himself? I went through letters. I went through about everything I could get my hands on to see if I could identify the phrase. And by the way, never did. So the footnote basically says, I have no idea. And as far as I can tell, there isn't a Lewis scholar who does know where it came from. So I wasn't alone. That's good news. So those are the kinds of even goofy things. And there were times when it did feel like a bit of a playing detective, a kind of a literary detective, to track down sources and references, and some were obvious, but some of them were a little bit harder.
As you were sharing, I brought up my ebook version, and the corner expression is in letter 21.
Okay. And one of the other letters, of course, he references a game called Conkers. C-O-N-K-E-R-S. And, you know, you're back to the, you can slip right past it or go, well, what in the world is Conkers? And so I had to go looking for it. And by the way, just so people aren't looking, that's also in letter 25. Conkers is a traditional English children's game played with the seeds of horse chestnut trees.
Very, very interesting. So. All right, well, let's go ahead and wrap up here. Now, of course, let me encourage people, they can go to their favorite bookseller, whether it be online or a traditional bookstore. They might have the annotated version to get a copy. It's in hardback or in ebook version. And then briefly, as we're wrapping up, first tell our listeners about your website and what they can find there. And then finally, give a couple key reasons and summary as to why people would want to consider the annotated version of the Screwtape Letters.
Well, we have several websites. One is my own, which is paulmccusker.com, and that's just mostly updates on projects I'm working on and pretty much how to get them. And then, of course, Focus on the Family Radio Theater has its website, which also gives some behind the scenes, not only audio but video that we produce alongside these productions. Interviews with the actors, that sort of thing, whether it's Screwtape Letters or the C.S. Lewis at War. So that proves to be interesting. And, of course, you can also go to YouTube and find some of those. If you put in Screwtape Andy Serkis, one of our behind-the-scenes pieces will come up. And the C.S. Lewis at War also has some material out there, too. And I would say for the Screwtape Letters, the annotated edition, the main purpose is, again, to illuminate and enlighten the material, to either give new energy to it for people who read it years ago and haven't picked it up since, or for those who have never really read C.S. Lewis because they found him intimidating or kind of hard to work through. I just thought an annotated version would be a huge help. And I will say one of the reasons why I did an annotated version was because on my shelf, I have dozens of annotated versions of some of my favorite books. I'm a huge fan of A Christmas Carol. And the year that Michael Patrick Hearn released his annotated Christmas Carol was an epiphany for me, because he went into the deep background of the story, of Dickens' life, of references that have become outdated. And my understanding of something as simple as A Christmas Carol just went out by leaps and bounds. Suddenly, I had a deeper understanding of what was going on. And for something as simple as A Christmas Carol, and you mentioned earlier something like Screwtape Letters, which is a very straightforward and wonderful piece of satire, there's a lot to dig out. There's a lot more going on than we realize. So for those who are interested in that, that would be one reason to buy the annotated Screwtape.
All right, excellent. Well, Paul, I appreciate the opportunity to interview you. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Finally, I'm William O'Flaherty, and let me thank you, the listener, for joining me today. Be sure to check the show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com for links mentioned in the show and for past podcasts. They include an interview with Douglas Gresham himself, along with chats with various authors like Dr. Alistair McGrath, Dr. Devin Brown, and Colin Duryea. That's EssentialCSLewis.com, where you can find other features like a daily fact, quote, and quiz on Lewis.